If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code Spotify for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Atlassian software like Jira, Confluence, and Trello help power global collaboration for all teams, so they can accomplish everything that's impossible alone. Because individually we're great, but together we're so much better. That's why millions of teams around the world, including 75% of the Fortune 500, trust Atlassian software. Learn how to unleash the potential of your team at Atlassian.com. That's Atlassian.com. Atlassian.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. In what ways was the medieval era surprisingly modern? Dan Jones, whose latest book is Powers and Thrones, A New History of the Middle Ages, wrote an article on this subject for the October issue of BBC History Magazine. And in today's podcast, he talks to our content director, Dave Musgrove, about the similarities and contrasts between the medieval experience and our lives today. If you enjoyed this interview, then you might be interested in a virtual medieval masterclass series that we're going to be running with Dan. It's four parts starting on Thursday, the 9th of September. Just go to historyextra.com/masterclass for more info and to sign up.
Dan, your latest book is A New History of the Middle Ages, and you've written an article for BBC History Magazine that ties in with it about the sort of the surprisingly modern aspect to the Middle Ages. Let's jump in to start with and just talk about what that term means. The Middle Ages, the medieval period, stretches from what do we say, start of the 5th century up until 16th century, big time period, big area as well. What does it mean? When do people actually start talking about medieval and Middle Ages with any certainty?
Well, I think the idea of the Middle Ages or a Middle Age sort of comes around in the 16th century, which is traditionally when we date the end of the Middle Ages. And one of the first people, if not the first person to use the term the Middle Age, is John Fox, the great ecclesiastical historian of the mid-16th century. And Fox talks about, he's talking about ecclesiastical history, but he says, you know, there was this, the primitive time, and that was the Roman Empire, basically, when the very, very first Christians were hiding in catacombs and trying to escape perfidious Romans who wanted to crucify them, or worse. And then he said, and then there's our time, you know, the modern age, when we're all much more enlightened and reformed. And he said, and in between, there's this sort of middle age. Now, we call it the Middle Ages or the medieval period. The terms are identical. And it's a strange time. I've spent my career writing about the Middle Ages. But it does encompass this 1,100 years. If we go from the sack of Rome of 410 to the sack of Rome 1527, which is what the book Powers and Thrones does, it does encompass a very, very long time, a very large geographical expanse, and a huge number of themes, which some of which are germane to the way we live our lives today, and some of which are completely obsolete. So I think people have traditionally found it quite hard to get their heads around what the Middle Ages were, what medieval really is all about. So what I've tried to do in Powers and Thrones is put it all together and give an accessible snapshot, although quite a lengthy snapshot in terms of the size of the book, showing what the Middle Ages were.
And you can sort of cut up the medieval period into numerous chunks, can't you? Your early medieval, your high medieval, your late medieval. Do those sort of terms have much use, do you think?
I think they do have use, actually. I think if you look at the period between the fall of the Roman Empire and the 5th century, 5th, 6th century AD, you see a series of competing entities within the Mediterranean vacuum that the Western Roman Empire had left. So in Powers and Thrones, I've written about the barbarian tribes who come in and establish the very first versions of what we now know as the nations of Europe. You've got a retrenching and changing Roman Empire in the East, centered on Constantinople, which becomes much more Greek-speaking and Greek in character than Latin. You have the rise of Islam and the first Islamic caliphates in North Africa, the Near East, Southern Europe, Spain, Sicily, and so on. And then you get to Charlemagne's sort of rebuilt Western, quote-unquote, Roman Empire. And I think if in the early Middle Ages, that's quite a useful block to look at in its own right. It has a narrative shape if you're trying to understand where the Middle Ages came from, how they emerged, what the political units looked like. It's still quite helpful to talk about the early Middle Ages. Likewise, around the first millennium, the year 1000, it's quite helpful to talk about the high Middle Ages. There are certain themes and there are certain things going on which can be usefully blocked into two, three, four centuries. So I think that terminology, it's old-fashioned, but it still serves a purpose.
And what about the geographical extent? So your book, it's a lot about Europe, but and you talk about in your intro that it's not covering other areas of the world as much as you might do, and other people, or maybe you might write that book down the track. But your book does talk a lot about Asia and Africa and the influences that that come into Europe. When is medieval Middle Ages a useful term beyond the boundaries of Europe?
Yes and no. I mean, that's such a historian's answer, I realise. But look, traditionally, the Middle Ages, medieval, is a term that is used in, let's say, Western historiography, and particularly Western European historiography. Some historians have started trying to alter the terms and make them a little more neutral, talking about a middle millennium, but really we're talking about the same thing. The challenge with writing a book about the Middle Ages, a sort of a broad-ranging book about the Middle Ages, is to acknowledge that this is a fairly Eurocentric term and that there are current strains of thinking in academia, which says that Eurocentrism is by definition bad. I don't necessarily go along with that. I do think, however, that it's the 21st century and we need to cast our view a little wider when we try and write big histories. So the balance when I was writing Powers and Thrones, I was always having to strike is, let's not lose this story altogether. We're writing about the Middle Ages. It is something that essentially emerges from Eurasian history and particularly from Western European history. However, let's try and broaden the lens somewhat. So in the book, I've covered the rise of the Mongols. You can't write a history of the Middle Ages without talking about Genghis Khan and the rise of the Mongols. So the story extends all the way to the eastern frontier of the Mongol Empire, which is Korea. You know, you're pushing that far east. you can't write a history of the Middle Ages without talking about the rise of Islam, which is a Northern African story as much as it is a Middle Eastern or a Southern European story. You can't write a history of the end of the Middle Ages without talking about the voyages of discovery to the Americas, without talking about Vasco da Gama and new routes through to the Indian Ocean. So I've tried to cast the net wide here, and it's a delicate balance. I think there is a great book to be written one day, which you've slightly alluded to, possibly not by me, although maybe by me, which is a history of the Middle Ages with the perspective completely shifted, completely flipped. So we're looking at this period in the Americas, in Africa, in Asia, and Western Europe becomes a sort of a sideshow. I mean, this is something that I've noticed has been done in recent years by scholars with the Second World War. I can't remember the book that I want to talk about, but the name of it. But it's a history. If you read a history of the Second World War with Russia in the middle, you get a radically, radically different view of things like, for example, D-Day or Dunkirk than you would in traditional histories of the Second World War. And I think that there's possibly a way of doing the Middle Ages with that kind of perspective shift.
That would be a fun book. I'm sure
it'd be a fun book. It'd be a very difficult book to write.
Yeah,
it'd be a very difficult book to write in a way that had scholarly chops, as well as making it accessible to a wide audience. You know, just having the cultural reference points available to an English reading audience. You know, you have to meet your audience somewhere in the middle. That's what I've tried to do with Powers and Thrones. I do think there are other ways to look at the Middle Ages as well.
One more thing before we start talking about sort of the more modern aspects to the Middle Ages is another way that medieval is used as a term is in disparaging terms in sort of modern journalism and popular talk. What does that exercise you as a medieval historian? Does it infuriate you when someone says this is a medieval way of doing something?
Not really. I just think it's lazy. Look, what are we talking about? When people say the Taliban are medieval, when people say dropping litter is medieval, when people, you know, there's this whole range of things that the word medieval is brought out quite lazily to describe, when it's really just mean it's sort of generically bad and somewhat backward. It doesn't particularly irk me as a historian because it's just, you're not going to change it. And I'm old enough now not to get too mad about things I know I can't change. However, it is lazy thinking, and it does suggest a lack of engagement with the Middle Ages. I think the problem is if you start saying we should stop using medieval as a pejorative altogether because the Middle Ages were totally fine, everything was all right, there was great art and great science and great academia and actually it wasn't bad at all, then you're also, that's not true. That's not, you know, if you give me the choice, where would I like to live in Southern England of the 21st century or Southern England in the 14th century, it ain't no choice at all. So it is slightly a problem if you try and flip it completely and say we should acknowledge the wonders of the Middle Ages. I just think that actually you can engage with the Middle Ages in a way that acknowledges that it's interesting and not just totally terrible, dark and bad.
So are you really trying to tell me you wouldn't have wanted to be alive in the era of the Peasants' Revolt? That would have been great fun, wouldn't it?
I can be very specific about this. I would like, if you gave me the option of time travel with a definite return ticket, I will take you up on it. Otherwise, I am not going to any historical period that does not have basic painkillers and anaesthetic. That's my baseline. That's the one invention I'm not traveling. You know, and when I say doesn't have, I mean freely available within like half a mile of my house. Okay, that's my rule. So don't come at me with your time machine, Dave Musgrove, saying I'm going to take you back to the Peasants' Revolt. I'm not going unless I take painkillers with me.
Exactly, but then you could prove or disprove whether your book was any good. Obviously, you've written about
that. But that sounds like Jeopardy to me. That's even more trouble.
Right. So that sort of outlines a few ways that medieval and the Middle Ages are used as terms. In the feature you've written for BBC History magazine, you've kind of outlined a few similarities between what's happening today and what happened in the Middle Ages. So I thought we'd just quickly go through them and just talk about what you ascribe. So the first one is climate change. The Middle Ages, I mean, as we've discussed, this is a very long time. This is over 1,000 years. So things were clearly going to happen. What was happening in terms of climate change? Can you broadly give us a sense about differing aspects to that?
Well, I think one of the advantages of writing a book that covers a long period, 1,100 years, is that you can tap into the great sort of ebbs and flows across not just a couple of generations, but across, dozens, scores of generations. And one of the things that I noticed early on when I started to plan out Powers and Thrones and work out what the shape of the book was going to be was that there were a few key moments in which shifts in the global or shifts in regional climate on Earth formed the framing device, formed the background to other periods of human change. So if we take the beginning of the Middle Ages, the Roman Empire, what have we seen during the height of the Roman Republic, Roman Empire, a period in the Mediterranean at any rate of climate conducive to good agriculture, warm and wet, and had provided the background conditions for the flourishing of human society around the Mediterranean, which the Roman Empire had taken advantage of by putting together trade networks to move food and people around this particular region. Now, when we look at the fall of the Roman Empire, so the beginning of the Middle Ages, you can frame that in terms of climate change. You could say, well, the two things happen. The first is the end of the Roman climate optimum. That is, that a natural movement in the cycle of the climate of the Mediterranean makes it less warm and less wet around the Mediterranean. And so you have things like the forests of the Atlas Mountains start to recede, and it becomes less possible to grow agricultural crops in marginal lands. You can't grow vines as far north as and so on. The other thing that happens is a sharper and shorter and more particular climate emergency, if you like, in the Far East, which is a super drought on the Asian steppe and around northern China today, which is the worst drought possibly in 10,000 years. And you can still see in tree ring data today. Now, the effects of this drought are to move nomadic steppe tribespeople who are called by others and possibly by themselves the Hun, to move them away from their traditional pastures and grazing lands to the east. The Hun move east. The Hun displace the Goths. The Goths and another tribe called the Alans, and the Goths are pressed towards the Roman Empire and eventually across its borders, across the river borders and the natural edges of the Roman Empire, destabilizing in the process the Roman Empire. It happens across several generations, but that's one contributory cause to the fall of the Roman Empire. Is it the only cause? No. Is it an important cause? Yes. What I've tried to do in the book is take episodes like that and frame them through climate change. There's a similar thing happens at the beginning of the 14th century. You see the relatively sudden onset of the Little Ice Age, a sharp fall in global temperatures, which brings along with it, coincidentally and possibly causally, heavy rainfall, flooding, famine, animal disease sweeping across Asia and Europe. The Black Death we know about, and then spiraling out from those basic catastrophes which affect people's means to survive, populist rebellion, endemic war, revolt, rioting, population crash. This is the onset of the Little Ice Age, and it brings with it problems that are not only climate related.
So those are quite short, sharp things that happened, which had dramatic consequences, I guess. Do you get a sense that people generally were talking about climate and sort of having an understanding of it changing over time and thinking about that?
No, and I think that that's much more something that's symptomatic of our society today, and our obsession with climate change is not only because there is climate change, and I'm by no means foolish enough to deny that there is man-made climate change. It seems self-evident. But our ability in the 21st century to count things, to count things and measure things and process that data has made us incredibly conscious of and prone to worrying about things that can be measured and counted. One of those things is climate change. Another, as we've seen at the moment, is disease. If you can count, process, analyze the data of the number of people who've got a particular respiratory disease day by day, almost hour by hour, according to the location, there's an observer effect at play, and there's an obsessional effect at play. Now, that not only applies to the society that we live in and how we interact with each other in the present day, it also applies to the way that we look at history. And so one of the reasons that in Powers and Thrones I've tried to bring in things like climate change and pandemic disease within a sort of a tapestry tableau narrative of people doing fun and extraordinary and violent things is because they are important to us today. And I believe that history is a conversation between past and present.
I guess if your life is much more dictated by agriculture and you're much closer to the land, much closer to the seasons, you would have a sort of a sense of when things were different, perhaps, or how whether your ancestors were working a different way. I think you allude to an idea that Viking archaeologist Neil Price has talked about sort of the thimble winter, this Viking idea of something that happened in the past that changed things. So sort of ideas of sort of folk memories of climate change and different ways that the weather operated in the past.
Absolutely, and I think the way that Neil Price in The Children of Ash and Elm deals with the feeding of ideas of a changing climate, possibly related to years without summer caused by volcanic eruptions, how that feeds into elemental Viking folklore. I think I thought that was absolutely brilliant when I read Neil Price's book. I think, and so you certainly see that operating in the Middle Ages. I think one of the other interesting things is if you're living through the Great Famine, let's say, of the early 14th century, you know, 1315, 16, 17, 18, 19, through 1322, almost all of those years failed harvests. Some of the years, no summer whatsoever. So forget it being a bit mizzy in August, as it just has been in 2021. We're talking about literally no summer. There's no difference in summer and winter. You wouldn't be able to get away from the realization that something was up. But of course, how do you process what you're seeing? Well, if it's the 14th century, not in terms of the way that we think about climate change as something essentially scientific and measurable, but it seems to come through more in it's viewed through a religious prism, and so it's viewed in terms of God smiting people and sending natural disasters as a corrective for or a punishment for sin.
Okay, so we've got climate change there, and we've got different responses to it, perhaps to the way that modern people do. You mentioned migration there caused by climate change, and that's your sort of second aspect of medieval life that perhaps is comparable to modern concern. So mass migration, sort of reading the early chapters of your book, it's basically just one long succession of people moving from one place to the other with consequences, isn't it? So very roughly speaking, you've kind of already done this super quickly, but who goes where and when in this during this period?
Well, the period of great migrations is the end of the Roman Empire, having the Huns and Goths having moved west. We start to see the movement of big groups of hitherto nomadic tribes into the west, particularly into regions that had been part of the Western Roman Empire, and then a period of settling. So some of those tribes, their names are still familiar to us today because they've given their names to particular regions of Western Europe. The Burgundians, well, we know where Burgundy is today. The Lombards, well, Lombardy, Northern Italy, we know where that is today. There are others whose names are familiar, but the territories they occupied may not be so familiar. Ostrogoths and Visigoths. The Franks, I suppose, were the most successful of all the migrant peoples and are most knitted into the cultural concept of the land that they occupied, ruled, which is France. So that from the 5th, 6th into the 7th century, I think that's the biggest moment where mass migration is forging the big story of the Middle Ages. But it's not the only one. You know, you could view some of the Mongol conquests as migration. You could view the early Arab conquests as forms of migration. You could certainly view the Christopher Columbus era voyages in the New World through that lens.
And what about sort of the concept of economic migration? Is that something that's worth talking about in this period?
What do you have in mind?
Well, people, I mean, some of those migrations you've talked about are more... You know, people are being pushed from one place to the other by external condition, whereas someone who's looking to move to advance their economic position, I guess.
Yeah, I see what you mean. Well, there's an interesting anecdote, I suppose, about this, and that comes from something you've mentioned very briefly in passing already, which is in the Peasants' Revolt of 1381. If we look at if we see the Peasants' Revolt as what we now call a populist rebellion across England in the summer of 1381, clear underlying tensions in London explode during the weekend of violence of the Peasants' Revolt, when bands of rebels are going around London saying they're going to kill all the Flemings that they can find, because in London, groups of Flemish merchants have been living within London and trading. And there's a sort of a root xenophobic hatred of foreigners, which is allied to the sense that foreigners have come over here and taken all our jobs. Now, and it's not only London. The Peasants' Revolt, you can certainly see this often in Constantinople, 11th, 12th, 13th centuries, as well as some of the cities of the Crusader states. I mean, you could view, in fact, that all of the Crusader states, Kingdom of Jerusalem, County of Tripoli, Principality of Antioch, County of Edessa, you could view these as migrant states. And there's a simmering hostility in the region to the fact that people from Western Europe, the Franks, the Franche, have come over here and set up on our land. And so yes, economic migration, I think, is a live issue throughout the Middle Ages.
And you just sort of you gave a good example of one modern concern about migration today, the idea that people coming over somewhere and taking jobs, and that brings up the question of identity and who is you know, should be in a given place any given time. What did people in the Middle Ages think about their local identity, their national identity? Did such things exist in such a way that they were able to worry about migration in the same way that we do today?
I think as we get towards the very end of the Middle Ages, there is a sense of, you know, the beginnings of the sense of nationhood. You know, certainly if anyone who's familiar with English medieval history will have this idea that probably from the 14th century onwards, the sense of English nationhood is starting to build into something we could recognise today. And along with that, yes, you do start to see people having a sense that this is their land and not for others. I mean, I think there's a lot of that. Again, to go back to the Crusades, I think if we look at the contest in Spain and Portugal for control between Christian powers and Islamic powers, that may not start as a religious struggle, but by the end of it, by the time you get to the 15th century, there is a real sense that identity, that where you come from, who you are and what you believe, is now inextricably bound up with your right to remain, your right to live, your right to occupy certain parcels of territory.
And one other way of looking at migration, one other sort of response today is to welcome it. So this is a good thing. We need different people coming to a certain place to improve economic conditions, perhaps. Did anyone actively sort of embrace and welcome migration in your period, do you think?
Yes, I suppose it depends on how wide you cast your definition of migration. There's an awful lot of slavery in the Middle Ages, which is a form of migration, not voluntary migration, but it's something that's enthusiastically pursued by a large number of peoples during the Middle Ages. I'm not just talking about the 15th century and the beginnings of African slavery and slaves being transported across the Atlantic. I'm talking all the way through the Middle Ages, from Roman times, you know, Viking slaving, Frankish slaving, slave moving people around is by no means seen as something that is de facto bad. In fact, moving them around is something that is welcomed in many cases because slavery is part of the medieval economy. It's something we don't talk about an awful lot, and that in fact we're getting more and more nervous about talking about. But non-racially defined slavery is an enormous part of the Middle Ages, and if you want to view that as involuntary migration, then there's loads of people that welcome it. Yeah, I mean it's a crucial part of the medieval economy.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
One of them that I write about, and this is not an uncontroversial topic among medieval historians, as the name of it suggests, is the Great Stirrup Controversy, the debate about the extent to which the importation of the horse stirrup from the east to the west around the 10th century leads to a far greater importance of heavy cavalry in Western European armies, and the birth of the knight, and how far the birth of the knight leads to a social revolution within quote-unquote feudal Western Europe.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/History Extra.
Oh, such a clutch pickup, Dave.
I was worried we'd bring back the same team.
I meant those blackout motorized shades.
Blinds.com made it crazy affordable to replace our old blinds.
Hard to install?
No, it's easy. I installed these and then got some for my mom, too. She talked to a design consultant for free and scheduled a professional measure and install.
Hall of Fame son.
They're the number one online retailer of custom window coverings in the world.
Blinds.com is the GOAT.
The GOAT.
Go to Blinds.com for up to 45% off. Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
So another point in your list of sort of modernish preoccupations in the Middle Ages is pandemics, pandemic disease. Obviously, we're all painfully aware of what COVID has done in terms of personal illness, worrying, disruptiveness into society as well. You've identified a few obvious pandemics that happened in the Middle Ages, the most famous one, I guess, being the Black Death. Do you think one of the things that's interesting as we've gone through this pandemic is a lot of people have made comparisons to the Black Death from mid-14th century and sort of said things about it. Is that useful to relate back to that pandemic?
It's useful in the sense that it's always either comforting or instructive to think about history when you're going through something as a society. COVID, partly the nature of the illness itself, partly its interaction with the way we live today, and partly our response has been a globally disrupting phenomenon on the scale that most of us alive have not seen in our lifetimes. So, of course, it's inevitable that we're going to mine history for other examples of pandemics. Now, the comparison with the Black Death, in epidemiological terms, in terms of sheer mortality, is kind of specious, because the Black Death ripped through Eurasia and in Western Europe killed between 40 and more likely nearer 60% of the people. It had a lethality that is incomparable with COVID. On the other hand, it did the same thing in the 14th century that COVID has done in the 21st century, which is to illuminate what a society is like and what its preoccupations are. Now, if we say in the 21st century, what has COVID taught us about ourselves? We are hypervigilant about personal hygiene. We are absolutely petrified of the idea of death. We move around a great deal, and we're great host species for respiratory diseases. We're obsessed with measuring things, an obsession I've already alluded to, and we're convinced that we can control absolutely anything via technology, which is partially, if not wholly, true. Okay, so that's how it illuminates That's how COVID illuminates the 21st century. Well, in the 14th century, the Black Death illuminates the 14th century in a similar sort of way. It shows how mobile this century has become. What relatively, for the time, fast and extensive links there are between the global East and global West. This is a disease that has its origins with the Mongols, comes via the northern Black Sea to Constantinople, to Italy, rips its way through Western Europe, as far as Scotland and Ireland in medieval times, in no time at all. It's not as fast moving as COVID, because the transport isn't as fast moving, but it sends radioactive dye into the networks around the world and shows you just how sophisticated they've become. Similarly, in its responses, if you think about the flagellant movement, which has its origins in Italy and is how would I describe the flagellants? It's a sort of religious, manic religious movement in which its adherents believe that by whipping themselves and scourging themselves in public, they will somehow draw down the mercy of God and alleviate the suffering of mankind in general. Now, we have eyewitness accounts from the height of the Black Death in the 14th century, from the streets of London, in which you have parades of flagellants marching around the streets day after day, whipping themselves, lying down on the ground, being whipped until they're bloody, chanting religious songs. Everyone turns out in the streets to watch them in the hope that this is going to cure the Black Death. Now, this happens in the 21st century. You're saying, everyone, get inside. This is a super spreader event. What the hell are you doing? This is a disease that has a pneumonic component. There's a respiratory spread to the Black Death. Get inside. Of course, but in the 14th century, it doesn't. No one's thinking about that. But it does illuminate the obsession certainly in Latin Christianity at that point with sin, with redemption, with penance, with physical scourging and sufferance of the physical body in the hope of achieving spiritual relief. So, yeah, the answer is there is a point in comparing Black Death and COVID, but it's probably not the point that most people hope to achieve when they make the comparison.
And if we're trying to think about ways, possible similarities between the medieval and modern mindset, I suppose one of the things that COVID has shown us today is it kind of surprised us, didn't it? Well, certainly here in Western Europe, perhaps it surprised us that this sort of thing could happen and mortality was right there in your face. Maybe not so much in other parts of the world. I guess in the Middle Ages, and particularly in the run-up to the Black Death, it wasn't such a surprise. You know, that pandemic's disease was more of an everyday risk to life. So were people kind of surprised about pandemics? Did they worry about things on a daily basis, do you think?
Well, I think that's in some ways quite a hard question to answer, because, you know, you sort of alluded to it already. I mean, how much were people in the 21st century worried about pandemics? Well, if you were, I'd been to Tokyo in 2019 and ridden around the subway with everyone wearing masks, like, huh, what's going on? And then you think, well, it wasn't that long ago since SARS. Of course, I say this only with hindsight. If you'd looked at the sort of government wonks lists of global threats, it wasn't Islamic terrorism that was number one. It was a global pandemic. So there was a sense that we were quite worried about it. In the same way that in the 14th century, for example, there had been outbreaks of plague here, there, and everywhere, and it was a known phenomenon. However, I think the surprise with the Black Death was the mutation, that you've gone from something that spread by flea bites from rats, and we still don't really understand this, quite how it mutated, but it's something happens to, that makes this disease not just spread from flea bites from rats, but to be spread on the breath, to spread person to person. It's human to human transmissible, and it's unbelievably virulent. And that seems to happen very fast. And it's shocking. People are shocked by it and they don't know how to deal with it. And or rather, they do know how to they've got a sort of sense. I mean, you just read Boccaccio and you see people do have a sense that you just run away from the disease, run away from it and shut yourself off. I mean, that's the premise of the Decameron, right? It's a bunch of rich people who, rich kids who leave Florence and go and hang out up in the hills so they don't get the disease. I mean, that's the right thing to do. You know, you call medieval a cardo, and you stay tight until either everyone's dead or everyone's not. But how much of a surprise was it? Yeah, look, plague was a known thing, but not plague like this. That plague like this hadn't been known probably for 800 years since the Justinianic plague. And even that is not certain, because historians think that it's possible that because of the paucity of evidence about the Justinianic plague in the 6th century, a lot of the data from the 14th century has been transposed back onto the way we've looked at the Justinianic plague. It's very hard to know how bad the Justinianic plague actually was. It's not hard to know how bad the 14th century plague was. It may have been unprecedented, completely unprecedented.
So we probably haven't got time to delve into the Justinianic plague right now, but you have to read the book for a bit more on that one. You mentioned there sort of globalization as one sort of possible cause of spread of pandemic of the Black Death. That's another of your points about how similar the medieval world possibly was to the modern world. You're going to have to pick a time point to this question, because I'm going to ask you how globalized was the Middle Ages. So you're going to have to say at some point, was it a global society?
Yes. Not as globalized as our society is today, by a long chalk. Didn't have the internet for a start. But Valerie Hansen made this point, I thought, very well in her recent book about the year 1000. You know, Valerie Hansen pointed to the year 1000 and said, that's a year that in theory we have a totally globalized society, because you have Vikings forming a link between North America and Northern Europe. There's a fragile but positive chain of potential transmission. So a coin, let's say, could in theory travel all the way around the world, and the Vikings are the link across the Atlantic, because the Vikings set up Vinland, Lanso Meadows, probably in Nova Scotia. There's intra tribal and there's intra regional trade within the Americas, and so it's possible for things to move up and down the North and South American continent. It's possible to bridge the Atlantic via the Vikings. The Vikings have trade links all the way to Constantinople. Constantinople is dialed into the Silk Roads. So yeah, something could travel from Korea to Brazil, in theory. Do we know if anything actually did? No. But it's not impossible that could have happened. So I think that that's actually quite a neat way of thinking about things. I think probably the greatest text from the Middle Ages about globalization is the travels of Marco Polo. And even if only 10% of the travels of Marco Polo are actually true, and I happen to believe that a great deal more than 10% of the travels of Marco Polo are actually true, this is a fantastic example of somebody from Venice, from northern Italy, who spends 25 years in the service of the great Khan in the east, and comes back and writes down these vivid memories, not only of the Mongol Khan's court, but also of all the places that the Mongols are trading with around the Indian Ocean, where the best place to get dried mango and watermelon sweets from is, where the best place to get horses from is, where the people are kind of savage and dangerous, where they're urbane and have sort of clean streets and flowing water. You know, it's an unbelievably brilliant and vivid read that just emphasizes the interchange between these two parts of the world. And it's not the only one. If you think about, there are other fantastic accounts from the later Middle Ages of people traveling from, say, the papal court. A lot of friars travel from the papal court as ambassadors going to the Mongol Khan's court, hoping to convert the Mongols to Christianity, hoping to involve them in the Crusades. And some of them keep diaries. So Giovanni Dapian del Carpine keeps this wonderful diary of his tortuous travel to the land of the Khans and back. And I think that those sources, when I was writing Powers and Thrones, were incredibly helpful at showing how people could move. It wasn't easy, but how they could move between the great regions of the world, how these places were more connected in the Middle Ages than perhaps we might think.
So it's kind of theoretical in a way, isn't it? Yes, and stuff could move. And archaeologically, people, you know, stuff is found. You know, Kat Jarman's recent book on River Kings outlines how a dirham from Asia could have made its way to Reptum in eastern England and could have been there. And, you know, that's an interesting take. But I suppose trying to understand the medieval mindset a bit and compare it to the modern mindset, can you make any observations on how a medieval person in, say, the year 1000 would have understood the world around them? Would they have understood more about the world than their locality, their village, their town? Would they have considered themselves to be in any way a global citizen? Or is that just a completely anachronistic and stupid thing to say, which I am prone to do?
No, I think you're playing devil's advocate very, very nicely there, Dave. I think on balance, the likelihood of any person you hoiked off the street in the 13th century considering themselves a global citizen is much lower than I walked out of the offices here in Hammersmith in London today and hoiked somebody off the street in West London in the year 2021. For lots of obvious reasons. We're a much more mobile and joined up society today than we were in the Middle Ages, and it would be fatuous to pretend otherwise. That being said, it's not impossible. And if you do take somebody like Giovanni Dapian del Carpine, who had travelled, from the papal court in southern France all the way to the Mongol court in China and back, then you do have examples of individuals who have made that journey and who would certainly have the right to consider themselves global citizens. But I just think that the chances of it are much lower. However, I think that we can caricature the Middle Ages as a time when absolutely nobody had any concept of anything other than a kind of flat earth and their own little village and a hobbit-like shire that they inhabited and nothing beyond. The truth lies probably a little bit closer to that than to friars travelling thousands of miles and taking years to go back and forth to the Mongol court. But There was a wider spectrum of understanding of the world in the Middle Ages than often we might assume.
Right, last one of our preoccupations, our modern preoccupations. Right now, we're very concerned and interested in IT and technological developments, and it's very much changed the face of the world, certainly in our generation and probably the generation before that. Do you see the Middle Ages as a time of similar technical innovation?
There are times in the Middle Ages of rapid technological innovation, and some of these have profound social consequences. One of them that I write about, and this is not an uncontroversial topic among medieval historians, as the name of it suggests, is the Great Stirrup Controversy, the debate about the extent to which the importation of the horse stirrup from the east to the west around the 10th century leads to a far greater importance of heavy cavalry in Western European armies and the birth of the knight, and how far the birth of the knight leads to a social revolution within, quote-unquote, feudal Western Europe. We haven't got time to go into the Great Stirrup Controversy in the detail it deserves. I've preceded it in Powers and Thrones for readers who are interested. Nevertheless, it's a good illustration of how an apparently small and simple to us today technological advance can have big social cultural consequences. I think another extremely interesting example of this comes right at the end of the Middle Ages, and in many ways is responsible for the end of the Middle Ages. And that's the invention, the popularization of movable print type, famously used by Johannes Gutenberg in his Bible. Okay, so the middle of the 15th century, the printing press comes along, and suddenly the creation of books, of pamphlets, of newspapers, as we'd call them now, and particularly of indulgences, to be sold by the church, production of these becomes easier by an order of magnitude than it ever has been before, because now you can print stuff and it doesn't all have to be copied out longhand. And I think that the social, cultural, political effects of the printing press lead to a comparable shift in the way that people interact with one another to the modern prevalence of smartphones which can run social media. And what I mean by that is that once you can print stuff en masse and distribute it for the Times relatively quickly, and it's much more open and possible for all, quote-unquote, ordinary, by which I mean literate people, to publish than it ever has been before, what do you see? Well, you see people like Martin Luther and Calvin and Zwingli and all the rest of them coming along, having incredibly sort of, for the Times, mad and radical ideas, writing them down obsessively and circulating them all the time, and then beginning to compete with one another, partly consciously and partly subconsciously, to be the most extreme and wacky and out there, and stirring up in the process the forces of reaction and conservatism and traditionalism, who go just as far in their direction with doubling down on refusing to change absolutely anything whatsoever. And these forces, you have a culture war. We call it the Reformation. But you call it the Reformation when you're talking about the late 15th, 16th century. Today we call it the culture war, and it's about a whole bunch of different stuff. But ultimately it's about identity and belief and power expressed through publishing. So if you like, and you're going to have to rely on my analysis of the culture wars as well as my analysis of the Reformation here, I'm afraid. But if you like, the printing press is not that dissimilar to the iPhone and social media. I mean, these two things have comparably massive effects on Western society, I think.
It's not that often we get an answer that takes us from the stirrup controversy through to the printing press. So that's, you know, it's a topic we don't talk about enough in terms of the great stirrup controversy. I know a man who's an expert on medieval war horses, so maybe I'll get him on to
He'll tell you everything I just said was wrong, probably.
So just thinking about sort of technology and technological innovation, there's kind of a sense, I think, perhaps that Western Europe, what we would describe as Western Europe now, was a bit of a backwater of technological innovation for a large part of this period, notwithstanding printing press that you just talked about. Is that true? Was technological innovation really going on further to the east in more Islamic territories for much of the time, for instance?
Yes, it's funny this, isn't it? I mean, it's become almost like a knee-jerk response whenever we talk about the Middle Ages to apologise for the West and to say, oh my God, yeah, we're just such a terrible cultural backwater. What you say is absolutely true. Look, innovation happened in the East. If you think about gunpowder, paper, movable type printing, stirrups. To return to your new favourite topic, this happens in the East and it moves to the West. So this is where innovation happens. The Islamic world is incredibly good at preserving and transmitting knowledge in libraries. So how do the works of Aristotle become revived in the West? Because they've been preserved, translated into Arabic in Islamic libraries. And then there's a great translation movement once the Reconquista captures some of those libraries in places like Cordoba. What's the West good at? Okay, even if it is a sort of terrible, dirty backwater and completely uncivilized, and Marco Polo does kind of allude to the greater sophistication of Eastern society, so you know maybe there's something in that. But what is the West good at? The West is good at stealing, if you like, borrowing, if you don't, technologies from other parts of the world, literature that's been preserved in other languages, bringing it in and folding it into the existing sort of skein of Western society, and finding interesting new uses for it. You know, the stirrup may well have been invented in China, Korea, or the Far East. However, it's in Western Europe that this humble little, that's a very Boris Johnson way to put it, this humble little piece of art, it's in Western Europe that this is transformed into, eventually into the phenomenon of Frankish cavalry, which go about the whole of the Western world and the Middle East in the crusading era, destroying everything before them. The stirrup becomes Frankish cavalry. The stirrup becomes William Marshall in the West. And we fold it into this literary, it finds its literary and cultural outlets. And the same thing is true with the printing press. The printing press comes along in the West, and what happens? We have the Reformation. We have this sort of epoch-shifting cultural, religious, social transformation. So I think there's more to it than just saying, oh, the terrible, dreary West, completely unsophisticated and, you know, in comparison to other cultures. That's just as silly as the old Victorian imperialist view of the sort of arc of progress being something intrinsic to the English-speaking Western world.
Right. We better wrap up on this one. So just we've outlined there a whole bunch of things which were in some ways similar between what happened in the Middle Ages and what happened today, and similar or different responses to. Now you've written your magisterial overview of the whole period. If I asked you to pick one thing that was a big difference, one substantive weirdness between then and now, what would you say?
One weird thing.
One disconnect, maybe. One thing that really we would find surprising.
I see. Listeners of yours in the southern United States might disagree with me. And for that, I apologize. However, you have to price in religious belief a lot higher in the Middle Ages than you do in the 21st century. We're just a much more secular society. We're not an unspiritual society. In the morning, Dave, I get up and I ride my Peloton bike, and there is a spiritualism to the exercise classes there. It is not a religious spiritualism. It's a spiritualism informed by California hippie mentality. And it's a spiritualism of a completely different degree. But it is there nonetheless. However, we are much kind of cooler on organized religion, you know, particularly in the West. There are differences I accept, but in overall social terms, we're much kind of cooler on organized religion now than we were in the Middle Ages. And to return in a circular fashion to an earlier point, or to a point that we sort of began with, one of the reasons that medieval is applied to, let's say, the Taliban, is because when you see an organization that is both political and religious, and that has fused its political, cultural, social, and religious ideologies unapologetically, it does sort of smack of a time when the Latin Roman Christian Church occupied a much more vigorous, active, and influential place in Western society, and that I think is the big difference between us and them.
Well, thank you very much. We've only really touched the surface of what you talk about in your book, Powers and Thrones: New History of the Middle Ages, which is on sale right now and is no doubt at the top of the bestseller list. You cover the whole gamut of the story from, as I said, from about, well, you actually go back into the Roman period and then forward to the end of the period in the Reformation. So a long period of time and a long area you talk about, and 700 odd pages of great reading. So if anyone wants to get a handle on what happened in the Middle Ages, then this is the one to read. So Dan, thank you very much for your time.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
That was Dan Jones. His book, Powers and Thrones: A New History of the Middle Ages, is on sale now, published yesterday by Head of Zeus. As I mentioned, Dan is also delivering a medieval masterclass series for us at History Extra, That's going to be over four consecutive Thursdays, starting on the 9th of September. For more information and to sign up, just go to historyextra.com/masterclass. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman and Brittany Colley. We'll be back tomorrow when Saul David will be speaking about the special boat service in the Second World War.